Hi there, minefielders. It's a super minefield this week because, well, what a week it has been in the world of American, and I suppose you could add Australian politics. We will try to traverse that terrain and pass the ethical, moral dilemmas of the modern life that presents itself to us in these very, very strange times. Waleed Ali is my name. My co-host, who's nowhere near as strange as the times, is Scott Stevens.
Well, you know, who could resist a political spectacle? If political spectacles are your thing, then you've been like a pig at a trough this week. They don't come much bigger than Super Tuesday. I mean, even the name. Super Tuesday. It's kind of awe-inspiring, isn't it? It is, of course, the day of the presidential primary season when the delegates of 11 states are up for grabs. And it's also the day, of course, when the presumptive nominees of each party can trumpet their credentials as being the people's choice. And when I say trumpet, well, I do mean trumpet.
I think if somebody is doing as well as I'm doing, and I'm not just speaking for myself, whether it's me or anybody else, but if I'm going to win five, I've already won five, but maybe it could be six, seven, eight, nine. Could be nine. Could win nine states tonight. If I'm going to win all of these states with tremendous numbers, and if I'm going to come in the worst is second in the two or three that I might not win, I think, you know, we're a democracy. I think it's awfully hard to say that's not the person we want to lead the party, right? You know, it's very hard.
Republican Party's presumptive nominee for President, Donald Trump. And he's absolutely right, isn't he, Scott? This is the dilemma that now faces the Republican Party because they hate him. The Republican establishment does not like him. They do not want him there. I was reminded of something I had completely forgotten about, actually, which was, you remember the last election? So leading up to 2012 in the primary season, Scott. And there was meant to be a debate that some news website, I think, was hosting. It was going to be broadcast. They'd booked the venue. All the Republican nominees were there. They were going to do it. And then one by one, they all started withdrawing over the choice of moderator. Mm. And it turned out that the choice of moderator from this particular news outlet was Donald Trump.
It was not.
It was. And
right?
They were so livid about the thought that he would be the moderator for their debate, it would turn into a circus, that they boycotted it. The debate had to be cancelled. It was extraordinary that this happened. The animosity to Trump goes back all that way. And now, here he is, in a primary race, funding himself, spending less than other candidates, way out in front. And for mine, incapable of being caught. And now you have Republicans kind of musing on air about whether or not they can use party rules to go behind the Democratic result, use superdelegates or whatever it might be, to go behind the party, the public result, the voters' result, the people's result, and just remove him from the entire race. But then you can't help but think, Scott, have they created this their problem for themselves, partly by the way they've run their politics over the past decade, but also by the fact that they let him be a Republican candidate in the first place?
Look, I think the only way of beginning to unpick that is by asking ourselves, well, what is it about Trump that other Republicans find so objectionable? And it really is a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, there is that visceral element, and I think that's undeniable, isn't it? I mean, there's this kind of long-standing feud going right back to Trump's flirtation with politics back in 2012. But let's also remember, Waleed, that to date, there has been concern raised about Trump's ungarnered language, about his inability to stick to a particular message, or, as our producer has been lamenting this week, his inability to finish a sentence. Our producer has been saying, there is no way this man can get elected because I won't be able to edit anything that he says. I mean, you know, newsrooms across the world will be united on that front. But I don't know if you've noticed, Waleed, that one of the big objections that's been raised more recently is, can this man defeat Hillary Clinton? And for many, many, many Republicans, it's not so much political purity that counts at this stage of the presidential primary season, but it's electability. It's whether or not this candidate can beat the other person. And that's why, I mean, Lindsey Graham, Senior Senator Lindsey Graham, came out. I don't know if you saw this interview that he did, Willie.
I heard about this. Yeah.
Quite extraordinary, where he used certain expletives to demonstrate the fact that his party had gone a certain type of crazy. But he said, but this is the real problem. He says, Hillary Clinton is dishonest, Donald Trump is crazy, and in politics, dishonesty always beats crazy. Now, again, there's a kind of...
What a choice.
it's extraordinary. So, again, there's an issue here that it's not so much that there's policy here that is particularly objectionable? I mean, there is, but that's not the big issue. The big issue is, can Trump bring us home? And that really is the great dilemma that the GOP finds itself in. I mean, can they in fact endorse this man? Can they thereby alienate themselves from, I mean, Trump's right, millions of voters who find in this person something that's resonated with them? I mean, it's a real political dilemma. And look, I know that, you know, you couldn't get two political systems that are more different in many respects than the spectacle of North America versus the rather more kind of parochial Australian politics. But, you know, this whole drama of electability, this drama of political parties being able or being willing to do the unthinkable in order to secure an election, we had something pretty similar happened here, didn't we, in 2013,
yeah,
where
definitely.
A certain former prime minister, whom members of that party had described as a psychopath and a party wrecker, well, the now leader of the opposition, this is the fateful decision that he made.
Good evening, everybody. I have now come to the view that Labor stands the best chance to defend the legacies of this term of government and to continue improving the lives of millions of Australians if Kevin Rudd is our leader.
Well, Ed, you actually formulated for us the question we ought to be broaching this week. Have a go. What should we be asking?
Okay, so before I do that, you're absolutely right to say that it has less to do with policy and politics, the positions, the political positions candidates have, than we might assume. I mean, people forget Ted Cruz wants to build a wall as well.
Yeah, that's right.
That grab from Bill Shorten was really fascinating, because what he was arguing, if you think about it, was in order to protect the Gillard legacy, I need to throw my support behind someone who's going to kick her out so that someone else can become prime minister so we have the best chance of winning. In other words, I have no fidelity to what this person that I'm now endorsing is saying. I just want to preserve what we've done in government, and so I need to win. And so I'm actually going to resort to someone that 5 seconds ago I thought was unfit for office. Republicans now, establishment Republicans, are running around saying the same thing about Donald Trump. He's unworthy, he's unfit for office, which is partly why his whole flirtation with white supremacists this week and his refusal to denounce them and refuse their endorsement has been such a big moment, because it goes to that question of who is worthy for office. But then the question becomes, if your leading guy, if you are a party and your leading guy is a person who is unfit for office, then at what point do you have a moral or ethical obligation as a party, as a movement, to lose? Like, at what point do you have to say, you know what, we're going to take the hit. We're not going to put up Kevin Rudd in the case of the Labor Party for election because we don't believe he's worthy of office. And on the off chance that we win, we're doing the country a disservice. At what point, if you're the Republicans, do you say, we can stop Donald Trump becoming president, we just disendorse him? He's no longer a Republican candidate. He has to run as an independent. What that probably means is the Democrat nominee almost certainly wins because it's a three-horse race and the conservative vote will be split between Trump and whoever the Republicans would put up in that case. So you're opting in that circumstance to lose. Scott, is there any point at which you're obliged to do that as an entity that exists to win?
Look, believe it or not, Waleed, I actually think that the issue is far more complex, I mean, as these things always are, than we might often think. I mean, one of the truisms, I suppose, that often circulates in political circles these days is you can't do anything from opposition. The only way of actually doing something worthwhile in politics is by getting into government. Now, it's not quite the same in the United States, let's confess, both
yes.
because of the substantive role that Congress and Senate and the Senate plays. I mean, a Congress and a Senate can effectively paralyze a presidency.
As we've seen.
It's not quite the same here. You also have far more regular congressional and senatorial races in the United States. And so, you know, it's not just all about an election. But let's not minimize either the role that a president plays, both in foreign policy, as we've seen, in terms of kind of setting an entire agenda for the nation, but also in many ways sort of galvanizing a sense of national identity. The real issue, and Waleed, I'm going to put you on the spot in saying this. You do realize that when you say, this guy might be electable, okay, this guy might be completely odious to the party, He might be eminently electable. He might stand us a better chance than the other person that we have or the other person we want to nominate. But this person is unworthy of politics. This person is bad or has trashed our party brand. And so we will not endorse this person. We will not select this person as a leader, even if it would be a shoe-in at the election. You do realize that in saying at what point does a party have a moral obligation to lose, the real lack of faith there is in the capacity or the judgment of the people themselves to discern through spin or through the kind of the epiphenomenal quality of politics to get right to the heart of good policy. So you realize that to throw an election, to deliberately lose an election, is to say, I don't like this group of voters as they are now. I'm going to wait for another.
Yeah, it probably is. Lots of horrendous people have been elected popularly before.
Yes.
But I think it's a little bit more complicated than saying it's about saying to hell with the people, because there's also the fact that you have information that voters are not given access to. The case of Kevin Rudd illustrates that. The psychopathic tendencies of this person, to use the words of his own colleagues, were not known to the public. They were hidden from the public. So you have access to this. Part of the reason that parties pre-select their own candidates in Australia is because there is knowledge within the party of who and who isn't appropriate for the job. And so I think it's not as simple as saying, well, I don't like the people's judgment. Parties always don't like the people's judgment when they lose. Mm. But it's also about saying, no, there is information that we in good faith must act on here. Now, maybe it's a little different in the case of Trump, because what's not liked about him is what's manifest. I don't know. It's an interesting thing that you raise, but I can't help but think there is an internal logic to the way that the Republicans and then previously the Labor Party are going about this or went about this that does bear some kind of scrutiny and at least raises the ethical question we have raised. Mm-hmm. You are listening to The Minefield, by the way. Leave a comment on our website if you like. Just search for RN The Minefield, or you can also tweet us at RN The Minefield.
Well, you know, Waleed, there are some weeks that I got to admit, I just love my job. I mean, just imagine that you were able to have here in the studio Kevin Bartlett or Royce Hart talking AFL and I don't know, the ethics of winning or something, you know, some sport
you must
topic.
Spend all week researching that little quip.
All flipping week. I had no idea who these guys were. And then I had to do all the back research to make sure that I wasn't getting these guys completely wrong. Kevin Bartlett. Am I right, Kevin Bartlett? Kevin Hart are two sort of Richmond stars.
So there we go. Royce Hart. Yes.
Well done. Royce Hart. There we go. Well, anyway, imagine if you had them in the studio. This is kind of how I'm feeling about our guest. Jedediah Purdy is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law at Duke University. He's a rare and remarkable political thinker and the author of what many would regard, me among them, a series of modern masterpieces like The Meaning of Property, Being America, and one of my all-time favorites, Four Common Things. He joins us on Skype from Duke University. Hi, Jed.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Waleed.
Hey, Jed.
So look, let me just start. I mean, we really want to shift the conversation now to Trump because you know, I do think there's something going on here beyond the monstrosity, beyond the hairdo, beyond the spectacle that people don't quite get. Let's get to his language. I mean, one of the remarkable things about Trump is that he doesn't use political language. There's none of the ritualized phrasing. There's none of the political platitudes that you see, especially on the Republican side of politics. And yet the very fact that he's proving so appealing with Republican voters, doesn't that say something about the hollowness of so much political language for many voters today?
I think you put it perfectly. As you say, standard political language in American campaigns has a liturgy that it runs through reliably. From Barack Obama to Ted Cruz, they talk about the American Revolution, the Civil War, the Constitution, the Constitution, the Constitution. And Trump is speaking an entirely different language. It's like he comes from a tribe that is just alien to these practices. His language is the language of personal aggression and the assertion of personality, personal strength, and it's the language of business, or actually it's a kind of caricature of the language of business. It's not actually clear what it is to make a deal, but Trump talks relentlessly about how many great deals he's going to make when he becomes president. So he's sort of opted out of and turned around to trash the usual way of trying to make things happen with language in politics. And I think you're absolutely right that by doing that, he is picking up on, channeling and amplifying a kind of exhaustion with that language, a disgust, a feeling that it makes nothing happen. It's basically fake. And Trump's kind of brutal and crude way of presenting himself. It's not just a matter of the sort of derogatory and nasty things that he says, though it's partly that. It's his kind of deliberately opting out of a whole lexicon and basically saying that politics as he's practicing it is nothing but a combination on the one hand of the direct projection of personal strength and power into the political domain, and second, is perfectly continuous with the activities of self-branding, self-marketing, the sort of the life of postmodern capitalism, that politics has sort of dissolved into those two things, and at least those are real, and politics is fake.
But also, that sort of language of self-marketing, that capitalistic approach you're talking about, is a deeply American dream anyway, right? So I still think he's tapping into something that exists in the American mythos, if you like. There's still something there. But it seems to me it's about more than language. It's about more. It's kind of about throwing off all manner of shackles, which is, I think, why his direct, unvarnished prejudice works so well. Why, when he says something that would get any other candidate disqualified or cause them to collapse completely in the polls, his numbers will go up. Why it is that he's capable of sort of flirting with white supremacist groups, people like David Duke, he's quite comfortable doing that because he's able to send a message of prejudices in all direction that sends a grander message, which is about you can say and be and do whatever the you don't have to apologize for anything. And I sense in that something that is actually quite American.
Dead on. And that's dead on. I would describe Trump as being almost post-ethical in the sense
yes.
that
there is
no there's no charge you could throw at him that would count. He would just like look right back at you and say, yeah. Yeah, and so? And as you put it, it's it hinges on a pair of things. One is, you know, Trump will say either whatever pops into his mind or whatever he thinks it'll take to win. That's his post-ethical ethics. That's his form
yes.
of consistency, and it's actually an inconsistent form of consistency, an inconsistency that's consistent with who he is and how he's winning as long as he keeps winning. And to bring it down just slightly to the campaign, but to make exactly the same point, both in the polls and in the very poignant anecdotes from people whom one knows or who are backing him, the theme that comes up again and again, and it's in his speeches too, is that what's crippling the country is political correctness, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It's being afraid to say what we think. It's being afraid to see things as we see them. And so in this way, Trump is performing as a kind of national id for a certain kind of alienated voter.
But there is another, and I love your description of a kind of post-ethical consistency, but there is another form of kind of consistency here that's really striking to me. I mean, one of the things he's been consistently critical of Barack Obama about is his reliance initially on deliberation. In other words, all talk, no action. And then his reliance on executive action instead of getting all the people in the room and making the deal. Trump's language and his entire persona is the language of disaffection, of action, and most importantly, of success. And, you know, going back through Wall Street, through Henry T. Ford, right to the kind of the founding myth, if you like, of the American settlement itself, that whole language of success counts. You know, there's this kind of deep pragmatism, even philosophical pragmatism that runs back in American life. That, you know, that's also being taken by even Democrat voters in many states as being a kind of, you know, a refreshing breakthrough from otherwise partisan gridlock.
Yeah, I think you got it. Winners can't be wrong. In fact, whether you're a winner or a loser is really the only question about whether you count and whether you're worth listening to. I think that's exactly what Trump projects, and I think you're right to say it is a deep American habit, and it is one of our worst, which is saying
right.
something.
Okay, but then let's go back to what we were talking about before, which is the responsibility, the obligations upon parties. Are the parties who decide that they will go with the candidate they do not like just because they think they'll get a better electoral result? Can we describe them as post-ethical as well? Or should a party say at some point, is there an obligation upon them to say, no, we do have some ethical framework at some point that kicks in and trumps even the thought that we would lose?
Well, so I would like, if I might, to turn the question around slightly in light of how I see the Trump campaign in the American setting, not to hijack it, though, and then turn it back to you. So I think that a part of the difficulty the Republican Party is having with Trump is that, in a sense, all of the stuff he's saying that's gone unsaid before is only what much of the Republican Party has been fostering in and promising to its voters for a long time. Yes, right? Exactly. This party has had a structural crack at its center since the early 70s, when it welded together a coalition of business interests that are basically socially liberal on the one hand, and the remnants of white working class and rural populism on the other hand, which had historically been economically left-wing and to greater or lesser degrees nationalist and racist. Essentially, the modern Republican Party took the symbolic and cultural part of populism and the substantive part of laissez-faire economics. That's always been an unstable pairing. And Trump is, in a sense, splitting it apart by making the racist and nationalist elements of the populism disastrously and alarmingly explicit while doing something very complicated with, but certainly not towing the line of the libertarians. So in that sense, people who say that he's the Republican Party's Frankenstein monster are not wrong. And moreover, his voters are not wrong to think that there is a deep divorce between political language and reality. That is, the person they're embracing as the vehicle of that perception is a dangerous nihilist who plays on bigotry. But the sense that what he's throwing aside is a kind of tissue of false and superficial verbiage, you know, they're not mistaken about that.
Yeah, and look, I mean, that actually brings us back, I think, to the crucial policy issue. I mean, in many respects, the kind of moral complicity or the moral compromises we've been seeing from various parties really, I think, comes back to a deeper abandonment of policy consistency. I mean, there's been a preparedness to ditch completely morally worthy, vital, intergenerationally, and just policies because they have proven variously electorally impalitable. And I mean, this finally, Jed, I mean, this again, there would be moral high ground that parties could adopt if they exhibited a degree of policy consistency in the first place, right?
I think that's right. I think that's quite well observed. I mean, American democracy working as it's when it's working, so to speak, has failed to do anything meaningful about climate change, to take the most salient example. Failed, I think, to come to terms in any very satisfactory way with our racial history. The high ground is hard to find. It's clear that President Obama has been very careful to conduct himself stylistically, rhetorically, and in many ways in substance as a political adult. And I think the kind of identity politics of the adolescent narcissist that we're getting out of Trump is a kind of equal and opposite cultural reaction to that manner, among other things. But the true moral high ground, the position from which someone could say, we have actually been looking out for the country and now we're going to continue to do so, even at the cost of self-sacrifice, is harder to find in a politics that's so pervasively tactical and shape-shifting.
All right, Jedediah, you're fired. Thank you very much for coming in and having a chat to us. We're out of time.
Loser.
There was nothing you could do about that. We all just had to sit there and take it, knowing it was coming.
By the way, Jedediah also has small hands. I just want to point that out. Jedediah Purdy is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law at Duke University. That didn't come from nowhere. Who was that? Rubio, I think, was saying about Trump. All right, Scott. It's entirely post-moral. Is that the conclusion we've reached now?
Just about. We'd love to hear what you think. You can visit us on the website. Just search for R in the Mindfield. You can also follow us on Twitter. You can just follow us at RN The Minefield.
Wonderful to have you company for this week. Next week we'll find some other thorny thing to talk about and we'll lock horns then. See ya.
Well, there's science,
music,
mayhem and malarkey, street life,
bush life,
food.
History,
philosophy,
politics,
funny stuff,
and enough's enough.
If you're curious about everything, so are we. RN Afternoons, 2 hours about everything, with me, Michael McKenzie, 1 till 3 weekdays, and online all the time, right here on RN.